Golf's one of the few places left where you get to be with someone and you got all that walk between the drive and the next shot. And you can have hilarious talks, but you can also talk real. And to me, that's what I love about golf the most, just the stuff you talk in between the shots and the stories afterwards and laughing your ass off and, you know, a couple beers afterwards and not too many and go home, you know, sober.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne, and you know what I'm loving lately? I'm loving the next tee. Walking up to the next tee with my new TSR driver from Titleist. For me, it was the TSR4 that was the perfect fit and has quickly become the favorite club in my bag because from the feel to the sound to the results I'm getting, I just want to step up and hit it again and again. I want to keep hitting driver. That's an awesome feeling to have that confidence and that excitement about hitting a golf shot. And that's because the new TSR driver takes everything that made the TSI the number one driver on tour and packs even more performance into every head. So if you want to get playing at Titleist speed, go to Titleist.com to learn more about all the TSR medals and schedule your fitting today. And today, a very special podcast for you recorded live in the Broken Tee Society, which is, of course, our clubhouse in the cloud. Now, if you aren't on our Discord server yet, it's free with your membership, and you're missing out on a lot of things, and it's easy to sign up. Go to your member locker, get on board. It's a piece of cake, because you get in the Broken Tee Society, you're going to meet other like-minded golfers from around the world, folks that are hanging in different rooms or different channels where you can talk about food or books or sports or gambling or booze or not drinking booze. Whatever you're into, there is a place for it on the server. It's just like hanging around, you know, after your round and talking with your friends, but you don't even have to play golf first. You can just meet golfers from your area. Perhaps I think the best thing you can do, though, is to tune into conversations like the one we're about to share here and be part of a live audience. So sometimes, you know, we have town hall discussions in the Broken Tee Society, and sometimes they are so fun or interesting that we share them as podcasts as well. And that was certainly the case with this discussion with acclaimed golf author, journalist, and Broken Tee Society member himself, Rick Riley. Now, you know him from his forever column in the back of Sports Illustrated and from so many golf broadcasts and 15 books as well. The one we get into today is his latest, So Help Me Golf, and he shares some of the best stories from that book and some very personal stories about his growing up in a household, actually, where he grew up hating golf, and then how he came to embrace golf as something of an escape. So even as we tread into some serious territory here, I think you're going to find that Riley, as usual for him, is really, really funny. So definitely a few laughs on the way here. And you know what else is on the way? Golfers Journal 22, dropping soon, very soon. I don't know how soon, but I'm looking at my advanced copy right now. So let's just say it's right around the corner. And looking at it, favorite back cover yet. No doubt about it. Can't tell you too much more about it. I'll say that the Chasing Scratch crowd is really going to like it. That's as much of a hint as I can give. Great front cover as well. Can't reveal that either, but I can tell you that we've got stories in here. They're bangers. One sort of literally is a banger as our publisher and owner Brendan Thomas plays golf with his favorite band, The War on Drugs, mixing music and golf in one of the cooler stories that we've done in a while. Just, this is a great one to read, but also to look at. Just an awesome, awesome piece. I've got a story in 22 as well about the Heathland treasures I discovered on a recent trip to England and why Heathland golf might rival Lynx golf for me now. I know, hard to even say that, but it might be the case. We've also got Golfers Journal contributor Will Bardwell in 22 checking in with a mafia murder story that has ties to championship golf in Biloxi, of course. And then how about a Crystal Downs yardage book written by none other than architect and Crystal Downs member Mike DeVries. Very cool. So some heavy hitters, more heavy hitters as well. Probably the funniest photo essay we've ever done. So get excited. It's all coming your way. And if your subscription has somehow lapsed, well, get worried about missing this issue and make sure you re-up and make everything current so there won't be any delay in getting 22 to your door. And the holidays, they're coming, of course. Order your in-laws the Golfer's Journal so you'll at least have something to talk about at Thanksgiving, right? I mean, hey, Fred, I can see it. You know, that magazine you got us. Wow, how about that story about the dinosaur? And there you go. Great holiday, family bliss. And of course, you know, when it comes to gift giving, it doesn't get any simpler or better than giving the gift of the Golfer's Journal. Of course, we couldn't make things like Golfer's Journal 22 if not for the support of our subscribers. So thanks for being a member. And thanks to the brands who support our efforts as well. And they are Titleist, Link Souls, Scotty Cameron, Links and Kings, FootJoy, Oakley, Charles Schwab, and BMW. Now, let's turn things over to Rick Riley, who was, for me, he was something of a sports writing hero. Because there were plenty of stories in Sports Illustrated that I didn't read in high school and in college, but I never missed reading his back page column. And after you hear what he has to say in this conversation about golf and about life, I think it'll probably be clear as to why his takes are always must-read stuff. Rick Riley, thank you so much for joining us here in our live recording of the Golfer's Journal podcast here on the Broken Tee Society server, which is our Discord server, our clubhouse in the cloud. So a chance for our other members to jump in and listen live. If we have some time for questions, maybe we'll get to that. But we do have a lot to talk about. Rick Riley needs no introduction, but I'll give you a short one. And you know Rick from Sports Illustrated and ESPN as the author. 15 books, is that about, you know, ballpark?
Yes.
Including Missing Links, Who's Your Caddy, Commander in Chief, lots of other golf titles as well. But your most important thing here, I note on your resume, a member of the Broken Tee Society yourself, a Golfer's Journal subscriber. So thank you for subscribing. And your new book, Why We Love the Game, came out in May, I believe, and we are here to
So Help Me Golf.
So Help Me Golf, Why We Love the Game.
Get your right hand up and like, So Help Me Golf, I'm crazy about this stupid game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why I'm staring at it right now, and I've enjoyed it very much. Eminently readable. And in your, I was thinking, you know, as I'm reading it, I mean, there's so many different stories that we can talk about. I want to talk, if we could talk about just quickly, if you could tell us sort of, give us the recap of how you got here. How, now as a sports writer, as a golf writer, I can recall, gosh, as a caddy, I can recall reading the back page of Sports Illustrated forever. And I didn't sort of have ambitions to be a sports writer, but I always thought you had the best job and I wanted to have a back page of something to be able to talk about what I wanted to talk about. And oh, I know cool. you probably influenced a lot of writers in that regard. So how did you get to have the best job in the world?
Well, it's so true because it was a different time, because I think it was the best job in sports writing because there wasn't 9,007,200 websites you could go to. And so you had USA Today, your local newspaper, and Sports Illustrated. That's all you had. And so to have the easy back page, 800 words, it was always 800 words. And I tried to make it easy for people. I tried not to put numbers in it so people that weren't that big of sports fans might like it. I really tried to write about people. And so I'd been at the Boulder Camera during college, the Denver Post after college, for 2 years, the LA Times for 2 years. I guess I did well during the 84 Olympics and got a job at SI in 85 at 27 years old. And then they started this thing called, it was called Point After. And so they said, who wants to try some of these? So I tried them and they kind of liked them. And it got down to three guys. They were alternating every third week. And so they gave it to a really good, funny writer named Lee Montville. Said, Lee, you're going to write it every week. And so Lee did that for about a year, maybe, and he didn't like it. And I said, I'll try it. I want to do it every week. And I remember, and so the editor said, well, what would be your ideas? And I sent him 100 ideas that I'd had squirreled away in my computer, because I always wrote ideas down, stuck them in my pocket, listened to people in elevators. I had a million ideas. And the guy's like, oh, you're set. And so I did it for, I probably did it. I was there 23 years. I probably did it for 15 years or something like that. And so it really was a great job. Now it's kind of different because every SI seems to have a swimsuit issue in it now. And there's 9 million places you can go for your sports stuff. And everybody has to write a tweet in 10 seconds. Man, I would get 7 days to write 800 words. Can you imagine that? And we flew,
it's a dream.
We flew first class.
It's a dream. No, it is. And I remember when we, even when we were, the Golfers Journal was kicking off, my first piece that I did was an essay. And I was sort of hoping like, all right, I'll be the essayist every issue. I'll just do, 800 words. And sometimes I still do. I do like the chance to write longer as well, but, it did seem like a dreamy job, and, but you worked very hard at it and did great stuff.
People are always like Bill Simmons would always go to me, how do you get so much money for doing 800 words? I'm like, dude, you don't see the 5,000 I kill every week.
Exactly.
Because it's so hard to get an idea that's going to hold up. You turn it in Friday, it comes out the following Thursday. It's got to hold up. It's got to be different than last week. It's got to get past the 3 fact checkers and the 2 lawyers. It's, if you were funny last week, you got to be serious this week, or it's got to be heartbreaking, or it's got to be crazy. It was hard. And some weeks it was easy, of course. But some weeks it was really like, God, you'd go through 20, 25 ideas. I remember standing up in a British Open press room going, I will switch jobs with anyone who's done right now. That's how I felt sometimes. It was hard.
No, and I hear you. I mean, because writing short and writing to that number word count and writing with that sort of brevity, it's not easy. If you don't do this and know, it's at least for me personally, it's easier for me to write 50,000 words sometimes than to try and make a point and to make something all come together in the space of 500 words. I think the shorter it gets, the tougher it can get as well.
Jim Murray, the great, my hero, Jim Murray, the great columnist, one time turned in a piece and he said, sorry, it wasn't shorter. I didn't have time. And that's exactly right. And I don't think young sports writers understand that. It's easy to just blather on and just do a word salad of 5,000 words about Kevin Garnett or whatever. It's harder to make those words really count, tell a story, act 1, act 2, act 3, have a kicker, make a point that's bigger than sports in 800 words. You got to really, all writing is rewriting. And for me, I would get done with the first draft and I'd polish it 20, 30, 50 times until it was, just right.
100%. I mean, I came out of a fiction writing program and, and we would always start as, all those programs start, writing short stories. And now looking back on that, I'm like, man, writing a short story is, to me, writing a great short story is so much harder than, it's like, let me write a novel. Because in 100,000 words, I'll get around to saying something.
Yeah, so short is really hard, and I think when Twitter came along, people realized that because people would take 10 tweets to what you're supposed to do. Back in the day, you were supposed to get it done in what, 100 characters?
Yeah, 140 or whatever. Yeah. So what's interesting though, that style that you've taken, that skill and that gift for that brevity and making a point in a relatively short space, it carries over into this book. So Help Me Golf. So. The book, I love the way the book is organized and how you're able to, tell stories in these really consumable, fun pieces and chunks. But you break them into different stages of your life as well, from being a kid to a teen to a writer to a father, a wanderer, a gambler, all these different aspects of yourself and different aspects of your personality as well. But all sort of broken down into different golf tales that you can sort of read within context or even sort of maybe out of context if you're moving around in the book. So just a really, really cool read. What was the genesis? Now, this is not, I should say, it's not a collection of things that you'd already written and just said, okay, I'm going to grab all my back pages and put them together into a collection. That's not what this book is.
This is all new. Yeah, this is all new stuff.
It's all new stuff. And so what was the driving passion behind saying, okay, this is the next project that I'm going to work on?
Well, again, I always had a little notebook in my back pocket, and I'd write down ideas and things I wanted to write. And you know, all those years of covering Super Bowls and U.S. Opens and stuff, there's all kinds of great stuff that happens that you never can fit in. So I would squirrel it away in this file, which was called Golf Book. And when COVID came, I'm like, this is it. After 40 years of squirreling away notes, I can write all these stories I've always wanted to write, make you understand, or make me understand, why I like golf so much. The idea that I even like golf is kind of amazing, because my dad, as I mentioned in the book, was a drunk, and he would come home from drunk golf, and could be violent, and we'd hide, and you didn't know what to do. I was 7 years old. You go try to protect your mother, or do you hide some more, or does your big brother go? And it was just terrible. And I always blamed golf. And I can remember the clicking of his spikes coming up the sidewalk, which means he was really drunk. He never even took the time to take off his golf shoes. And I hated that sound. And still to this day, it kind of gives me that little horrible feeling in my stomach. And but when my brother got to be 17, he got my dad's old clubs. And he said, come on, I'm giving you my old clubs, or you're going to the range. I'm like, I hate golf. I'm not going. And he dragged me to the range. And I was like, wait a minute. People aren't drunk out here. And look, we can make this ball go all kind of ways. And I just fell in love with it there more than probably is healthy. And so I always wanted to write that story. But my little story about why I came to golf and why it's such a great, you know, like I played high school baseball and stuff. My baseball stories end at, you know, 18. My golf stories go on to this day. And, you know, for a guy that came from kind of a messed up family, those guys I played with for 40 years are my family, you know, and yeah, we're all a little out around, but it's been a great life in golf. And I kind of wanted to tell those stories, and not about me, just about everyone and how their lives were affected so deeply by golf. And so I was going to, can I tell this one story just to give people an example?
Please.
In 1965, a U.S. Air Force pilot named Colonel George Hall was flying above North Vietnam, gets shot down, gets put in the Hanoi Hilton, a terrible prison in Hanoi, and they stick him in a 6-foot by 7-foot cell. I saw the cell, and he was in there for 4 years in isolation in that horrible cell with no windows, freezing. And one day in his first month, he found a stick. He hid it in his pant leg, and the guard didn't see it. And he came back into his pant leg. And every day, Tom, every day for the next 4 years, he played golf. He was a college golfer, and he was from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, belonged to Hattiesburg Country Club. So he'd get up, put on his golf shoes, kiss his wife, get in the Buick, drive through town, wave at the grocery store owner buddy, wave at the guy that ran the used car lot, pull in, kid with the shoe shine guy, get to the first tee, see his three buddies, and he'd swing. And he had a good swing, and he hit it about 240, 250 every time. He'd pace that off. Oh, pacing it off in this tiny cell. Now he's left to see first hole at Hattiesburg. He's left with 152 yards. That's like an 8-iron for him. It's the 8-iron, paces that off. Now he's got a 25-foot putt, right to left, breaks 2 feet, puts it up to the hole, always made par, never made bogey, never made birdie. They watch his friends play, get to the second tee, third tee. Oh, fourth hole, there's Mrs. Havermeyer, you know, watering her hedges. Hey, did Phil ever fix the roof? No, he never did. Oh, hope it doesn't rain. Ha, ha, ha. And they play the 18 holes, sit there, have one beer with his friends, put his shoes back on, and drive home. And when he returned in real life to Hattiesburg, he was 102 pounds. He left at 172. And they said, there's some people out there on the airport tarmac want to see you. And the whole town was there. And he gets to the podium, and he sees the grocery store guy, and he sees the used car guy, and he sees his buddies he played golf, and the shoe shine guy. And he just starts crying. And what he tried to tell them was, you people, this game saved my life, because in my mind, I was able to leave the cell. And that's what kept me alive when almost everyone else I knew in that prison died. And that's what I mean about golf. It's more than just a game, you know?
That's one of the great stories. There's so many, but that's one that really stood out to me as well. You actually went to see the cell?
Oh, well, we always go to, we love Vietnam. So I said, I've got to see where McCain was. And then, so there's not many cells in it. And so I went and looked through every cell. And so I know I was in one of his cells.
Wow. That's what a story. Yeah.
I wonder what he did with
the game. What did he do with the stick?
I don't know.
Then when he got home and then there were no more, you know,
and imagine by the time he got home, it was 7 years, and his son, when he left was 7, is now 14.
Wow.
And so the son is now a golf pro in Alabama, and he's a great guy. And he said, but it was hard. I mean, here's a guy telling us what to do, you know, and we don't even know this guy. And I was thinking, God, this is almost the opposite of my problem. I knew this guy too well, my father.
So speaking of your father, that was definitely, you know, that story that you just talked, there are a lot of standout stories in the book. And as I picked up So Help Me Golf, I thought, great Rick Riley book. Like flipping through, I could see there's, you know, they're relatively sort of short, punchy stories. They're going to be great. They're going to be funny. They're going to be insightful and surprising and all that stuff that we've come to, you know, expect from your work. But honestly, I didn't expect to lead right in with what you just talked about, the relationship with your dad. And you mentioned, I thought, one of the most stirring sort of details in the story is that sound of metal spikes coming up, you know, the sidewalk or the, you know, into the house. That really, really stuck with me, I think. From a writing, I think that's just a detail you just crushed, knocked out of the park from a writing point of view. I think sound can be so evocative, and we often, it's an image, you know, we often stick with images, but you just using a sound, it just absolutely was really effective. Why was this the book in the time where you said, okay, I want to tell this story. I'm going to go hear about my dad, because it's not just that one. It's a through line. It goes all the way through the book to the ending, to you thinking about yourself as a father and as a grandfather. So it adds, to say it adds gravitas is does not even sort of do justice to what it's about, more than that. You're doing something here that's really, really honest.
When I really decided to do the book, during COVID, my son and his son and his wife stayed with us for 3 months. And there was this 2-year-old son that just whacks the golf ball, just smashes it, the wiffle ball inside the house, right? And I was having so much fun re-teeing it, and he'd smash it and bounce around the four walls. And like one time it ended up back in my lap, and I did a double take just to make him laugh. And he doubled over laughing. It suddenly hit me that he's never going to be scared of golf. He's never going to be scared of his dad. He's going to have this great life discovering golf. And I realized, you know, I think I said in there, kid, you're going to have so much fun. You're going to wish you were twins. And that's when I decided I need to write about my childhood and how this has now come full circle. Because something about having a grandkid makes you realize, all right, you did your job. I mean, this is full circle. But also just the fact that golf isn't something scary to him. And so that's when I started writing. I think I started writing that day. And, you know, I don't know about if my brother is listening, but my brother really, he really saved me. He taught me how to fix cars and get girls and play golf. And he was just this great guy that without him and my two sisters, I mean, I'd probably be more messed up than I am. But I remember one time my brother, we hated playing with my dad. So we would sneak away to these terrible munis. And then one day, so he's probably 19 and I'm 12. And he says, we're going to Denver. We're from Boulder, Colorado. We're going to Denver to play golf. And we're going to play 36. I'm like, let's do it. And he had this old Ford where the hood would come flying up sometimes. So he had to tie down the hood because we were going to go on the highway. And we had two tee times, I remember. We go to this muni in Denver that we thought was the nicest course we'd ever played. Now I know it's pretty bad. But we played it, and we just had so much fun. And now we had got a hot dog in the car, and we had 45 minutes to get to our other tee time in Park Hill in Denver. And people in Denver might know it's kind of a muni that needs a shave and a clean shirt. Then we get there, and this is beautiful. We go into the pro shop, and we said 120, and my brother goes 120, Riley, and the guy goes, oh, you're not on the book. And he goes, oh, I made the tee time 120, Riley. And the guy goes, ah, there's nobody out there. Go ahead. And he grabs me and says, we're going, because we figured the guy's doing us a solid. We got there. They're handing out. There's a basket of free tees, free ball markers, ball fixers. The tee is better than any green we've ever played. We're like, holy shit, we're going crazy. And he hits his drive. He hits his little cut drive. I hit my little skull drive. And we're walking happily down the middle of the fairway when the guy from the pro shop comes flying up in front of us, does the fishtail golf cart move, stops us and says, you guys know where you are. And my brother goes, Park Hill? and he said, no, you're at the Denver Country Club. And we're like, oh, shit. And I remember we had to get in the car. We couldn't even go get our new balls. And I said, bro, that was a brand new Top Flight 7, you know? And then later I lived four blocks from that fairway and joined the club. But I remember it was never as thrilling as it was that day to hit one shot. But, so that my brother, I really owe so much to him. And it was just moments like that that helped me grow up.
Yeah. I mean, you talk in the book about one of your pastimes being, as a young man sneaking on golf courses. Right. And so starting strong there with Denver Country Club. I am curious, what do you think, in talking about your dad, what do you think growing up in that kind of circumstance, what role does that play in the success that you have? You allude to it a little bit, being the sort of youngest in the family and making that you sort of something of a fixer. I asked that because it's interesting. We had Tom Doak on this podcast about, a month ago, and he talked about growing up in a similar environment and how that made him want to achieve and do well and be something so that it sort of takes away attention from the things that aren't so nice.
Dude, I feel like you stole my therapist notebook. This is exactly right.
Well, I think I'm in the same boat, y'all. So
yeah, it's exactly.
We've all been to the same therapist.
So the youngest in an alcoholic family is known as the mascot, and so I would always try to be funny to keep the peace because it was just a really tense household. And my brother always kind of wanted to fight him, and my sister would try to mediate, but my job. I didn't realize this at the time, but through therapy, I've realized I was the guy that laughed and did skits and was funny. And I had a newspaper in the first grade that was full of jokes. And, I was always doing stuff to make everybody laugh and forget, we had this very scary guy living in the house. And so you're exactly right. That in a weird way, that really did help make me choose this great fun life I've had because I can write humor and I can tell stories and I can tell them to where people get kind of lost and don't whack on each other, So that's a great question. No one's ever asked me that, but yes, I was the funny mascot.
Well, yeah, that's where humor comes from. It doesn't, it comes from this place of wanting to, gain some middle ground with someone else. Laughing is a moment of recognition, and you want other people to sort of, by laughing at you or laughing at what you're saying, you're not only sort of lightening the mood and making things feel better, you're making people, it's approval. It's right. Approval out loud.
It's funny.
And approval, man. That
living here, and writing movies now and writing streamers and knowing people and, playing at Bel Air and stuff, you play with comedians. They're not really fun.
Right.
You see a lot of times, especially stand up, it takes a lot to get you up there and be willing to humiliate yourself in case it bombs. Because I tried stand up and it's hard. And still, comedians are really not fun to play with announcers are really fun. Like Bob Costas, like he'll announce his own golf swing. He'll be like, Costas, a little over top there. Oh no, he's pulled it. Like, how do you do that? And he goes, I really can't turn it off. And I got a story there. I was playing Hillcrest in LA with Al Michaels, the announcer. And I hit this really good 9-iron over the pin, 16th hole, and it starts to spin back towards the pin. And Al just launches into play-by-play. And he goes, hold on, folks, we're not done yet. It could be. It might be. It is. And it went to the hole. And I was like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Al Michaels called my hole-in-one.
And, that is the best.
And, you know, he said, you know, people, because I'm always talking to him about this and that. And I asked him once about do you believe in miracles? And then he said, you know, when I called your hole-in-one, people think you believe in miracles was set up. Like I'd rehearsed it. You know, it just comes out of me. This is what I was born to do. And I witnessed it that day.
Oh, he should have dropped a do you believe in miracles on you for the hole-in-one. But still, it's pretty awesome. I'm Michael's there.
I got my
narrating.
Own.
Man, you have played with so many people. Who's your favorite, if you had?
Well, the day with Bill Clinton was really fun. He was president of the United States. We got in the limo. I'm a big presidential scholar. You know, I love learning about presidents. And I always wanted, and there were 13 cop cars, fire trucks, all these security, Secret Service, SWAT. And yet there we pull in a Congressional Country Club and we changed shoes on the trunk of the beast. I guess that's how they wanted, the Secret Service wanted to do it. I'm like, I lived this life changing shoes in the parking lot. And I remember we were in the car and he had this black bag between us. It's kind of tight in there. It's not that big. I guess because the windows and doors are so thick. And I said, because I wanted to know what was in the bag. I was sure it was like the red phone or the nuclear football or something. And I said, can I see what's in the bag? He goes, yeah, I want to see what's in the bag. Go ahead. And I zipped it open and it was Twix bars and Pepsis. Oh, you can make it hungry out there. And we played and he had 24 clubs in the bag. So he's not a real stickler. And he'd hit what we call Billigans. He would hit a shot and he'd play his shot, but he hit 5, 6, 7 of these extra shots, which is absolutely cheating, but kind of in a stupid way because you just wear yourself out. And he had this caddy, was 72 years old, having to get all these extra shots, and he'd kind of get on his toes and hit it kind of sweepy right, you know? And so these SWAT guys weren't helping him get the balls. Nobody's helping him get the balls. We had 13 Secret Service and a staff following us. And finally, this poor caddy's just dripping sweat, and he gets to the tee box, and he says to the President of the United States, he goes, get off your toes, you ain't no damn ballerina. And everyone just freezes. And the chief of protocol's there, and the SWAT guys are looking at him. And I was thinking, oh, shit, you know, if we were in Iran or something, or, you know, Iraq, this guy's tongue would be cut out. And then we'd go find his kids and cut out their tongues, you know. But in the greatest country ever, Clinton goes, sorry, my bad, I'll work on it.
That's awesome.
It was really fun.
That is... So speaking of presidents, I mean, you wrote a book about golf, a golfing president. And so before there's so many stories in Help Me Golf I wanted to touch on. But I certainly wanted to know, you know, Commander and Cheat, a great selling golf book. And I'm curious, the writing about Trump and golf, what was the fallout? What was, as a writer, that sort of subject going there, that makes me feel like, wow, I can only imagine what your emails look like.
Oh yeah.
Or maybe it got worse than that. What was the fallout?
I did this book, excuse me, called Who's Your Caddy? A caddy for 12 famous people. And when I got to Trump, he said, I got nobody to play with, so you're playing with me. So we played and he took 7 mulligans. He took a gimme chip in, which I'd never heard of.
A gimme chip in.
We were playing a metal bet, so who had the lowest score got $10. Because he's, you know, I was a 12, and he said he was like a 5, so he gave me 7 shots. But he was more like a 12 or 11. But anyway, he was just cheating to try to cover this low handicap. But he was fun. But he's cheating like crazy. And so I got lucky on a par five, and I hit it into like 2 inches for birdie. And he's laying off the green in four. That makes this good, and he picked it up. and he's had his own. He always has his own cart that he messes with the governor so it can go really fast. And I'm like, did you just take a gimme chip in? And by then he's gone, you know. But then again, he buys you the cheeseburgers and the Pepsis afterwards. So anyway, he had told me, you know, I have, at the time, he goes, I have 13 club championships. And I'm looking at this really flat, kind of funky swing and a terrible around the greens, good putter. And I'm thinking, no way on earth. And I said, no way, Donald. And he goes, no, what I do is whenever I buy a course, I play the first round by myself, and that's the club championship. And I'm like, that's diabolically clever. So when he's running for president, I'm living in Italy, and I see him say, I've won 18 club championships, and that's why you got to vote for me. I'm a winner, and that's against the best players in the club, the young guys and everything. I said, wait a minute, this is bull. And so I called up my buddy that runs the Athletic. I said, maybe there's an article in this, because I know he didn't win 18 club championships. I don't want it to be political, but I just want people to know this guy will fudge the golf score. And so he said, yes. Yeah. So I started researching it, and then I found six more where he wasn't even at the course that day, and it was ridiculous. And so I started looking at his handicap. He said he's a 2.8, and I'm like, you know, Queen Elizabeth's a pole vaulter if you're a 2.8, and, you know, just and more and more stuff. So I started pitching it as a book, and so it came out. So it's not a political book. It's kind of just a hilarious book about what a guy will do to win a bet. And if you take 10 bucks off him, he almost pulls the 10 in half before he'll give it to you. He just can't stand to lose. My buddy took 20 bucks off him, and he said to him, it's okay. My girlfriend's a supermodel, and I drive a white Rolls Royce. So anyway...
Okay.
So I did this book, and oh, you know, we heard a lot from security, and they said, you know, you really shouldn't be around your house when it comes out. So my wife left for a week, and I went on the road and just hoped I didn't get shot. And
yeah,
I remember at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which is an area full of hate groups, and there's about 300 people in the auditorium, and I'm going to talk about this book. And somebody had gone into the library and tried to hide the book because it's propaganda. So we don't want propaganda in this library. And so I brought 10 more and hit them around the library. Anyway, I'm about to go out, and these four cops come to the green room, and they go, Mr. Riley, we're your security detail. If there's any shooting, we want to show you what you're going to do. I'm like, shooting? And the guy goes, oh, yeah, 2 years ago, there was a shooting at a city council meeting in this very room. I'm like, holy F, do I have to go out there? But I knew I did. And so they gave me what I was supposed to do and duck and run for this corner. But it was all great. Nobody even asked a hard question. But I've had a lot of emails and people at book signings. And mostly what they want to say is, what's this got to do with his presidency? Because they'll admit he cheats. They know he cheats at golf because he tells people he cheats at golf. And I said, nothing really. Except that how you do one thing is how you do everything. And I said, I remember I played golf with Arnold Palmer a couple of times. And every time we played with some guy he'd never met because he wanted to do business with him. So I said, Arnie, why do you do this? And he goes, because I can know a guy in 4 hours better than any other way, whether he's going to cheat, whether he's going to be generous, whether he's going to be funny, is he too serious? And I will know that in 4 hours. And so that's why I wrote the Trump book.
Wow. Well, first of all, so many questions, but just one. So who booked you in Idaho to do a talk about a Trump book?
Well, what happened was this guy had gotten the New York Times that this guy had written a letter to the librarian and not signed it, hidden all the Rick Riley commander in cheats because it's propaganda and I don't think people should read it. And so I said, oh, I'm going to fly up there and leave 10 more. For free. Anybody can take him if they can find him. But he also did Colbert's. Colbert wrote a funny book making fun of Trump.
Yeah.
And he said he's hit that one too. And so Colbert sent a 5-foot by 5-foot book and said, try to hide this one. And so I said, well, I'm coming up there to do it. And pretty soon the library says, well, we got all this interest. Would you be willing to speak? And so that's when I did it.
Wow. Hey, good for you. Right. Go for it. So many stories in the book I wanted to talk about, but speaking of people and learning about people on the golf course, someone who's been in the news a lot lately and is mentioned in your book as having some Greg Norman stories that you hadn't been able to share before, and you can share with us here. What are your thoughts on the Shark?
Well, you know, I knew him so well back then, you know, because he was always in the lead.
Yeah.
You know, he had the Saturday Slam and all that. And he was just the coolest guy with these piercing blue eyes. And it seemed like he was always walking in front of a wind machine. And he was always like, he'd take me in his helicopter and he'd fly like 10 feet above the waves. It was like terrifying. And I remember being in a helicopter once, we were going to some boat show. He's just always trying to prove something. I don't know what it was, but he was always, he did tell me what it was. He said, my dad never hugged me. He never loved me and he never hugged me. And so I remember when he lost the Masters after a 6-shot lead, and he loses by what, 7 or something to Faldo. And I get him in the parking lot at Augusta. And I said, so how was that? How you feeling? He goes, you want to know something weird? This is off the record, he said. I said, what? He said, that hug Nick gave me. What hug? The hug on the 18th green. I'm like, yeah, that was the greatest hug I've ever had. I've never had such a warm and real hug from a man. And he said, it almost was worth it because it almost made me cry because I never had that from my dad. And I'm like, yeah, what? That's what he said. And I'm like, whoa.
That's what he said.
And I'm like, but he wouldn't let me write it. I don't think I've ever told that story, but I think a lot of his, what's going on now and what's going on back then, you know, I took a submarine to the tournament. Oh, I flew my jet. I parachuted in. He was always trying to show what a man he was, right? And how tough he was and how and I think that whole chip on the shoulder thing is kind of what's going on with LIV Golf. He always felt like the PGA Tour didn't treat him right or didn't showcase him enough. I mean, he did win 93 tournaments around the world. And I think he was always mad about that and trying to get even.
Huh. That's right there. That is not what I'd expect them to be talking about in the parking lot, but that
yeah, right.
does tell us. That certainly tells us something. Also, you know, in the book, so many different characters. Another one that's interesting is you get into the Jack versus Tiger debate. And give us your, you know, greatest golfer ever. You give Jack the nod for a simple reason. Tell us why that is.
Well, it's pretty simple. He won more majors, kept his career together, kept his life together. Didn't go jumping with, you know, the our U.S. Army Rangers and screw up his knee and mess up his back. Didn't get into one of the world's worst sex scandals. Believe me, I have never seen a guy with the skills of Tiger Woods. But it's more than just having the skills. It's finishing your career. I mean, he's still winning majors at 46. That was pretty amazing. And so, to me, the guy that won the most majors is the greatest. And people are, it's, you know, I call it the blockbuster theory of life, where you go in Blockbuster and there were no movies before 1985. And that's kind of how people are with golf. Well, there's nobody great before Tiger. Well, hell yeah, there was. There was a guy called Bobby Jones, won 7 of 12 majors in a stretch. And, you know, Jack Nicklaus would win every third one. So, yeah, people are always like, you can't say that about Tiger. Yeah, I can. And I'm really sick of people going, oh, look what Tiger's been through, though. Tiger, if we were tennis, these would be unforced errors. You know, you hurt your leg screwing around. You got in this sex scandal. 3 times you've been, or twice at least, you've been caught driving with pills. These are not what Tiger's been through. What he's been through is falling asleep in his car, and he went through the oncoming lanes 20 minutes from my house. So I think it's always funny with me with Tiger. They don't feel like he has any culpability in what's happened to him. So yeah, he's a nicer guy now. He seems to be a smile more and everything, but you can't just feel sorry for him. He did this to himself.
And that comes from a section in the book. One of my favorite sections was I think it's your intermission when you talk about stuff that I hate in golf. And one of them being people saying poor Tiger. But your relationship with Tiger, there's also a lot in the book about, you know, you knowing you spent a lot of time with him and his dad. So where do you fall out on Tiger? What's your relationship with Tiger like?
Well, it's not good, like every reporter's. It's very difficult to get a one-on-one with him. I don't have his number anymore. He doesn't, as I say, Phil lets you into his life for better or worse. Like he has an open, like he's like a new 7-Eleven. He is just open. Whereas Tiger, man, he sets two Dobermans at the door of his life. We hardly know anything about his private life anymore, which I guess is fair, since he went through a horrible sex scandal, but we didn't know much about it before. So what's my relationship with him? I find it very hard to get past the veneer with Tiger.
Yeah. So a lot of characters in the book. Oh, Bryson as well. What's your take on Bryson DeChambeau? Do you really think he's a genius?
I do. I think he's brave. I think he's really smart. I think he's too smart. Justin Thomas told me this great story. He said, at Augusta, you know, he said, Bryson brings all these gadgets, right? The thing that measures the moisture in the grass, the air density ungulator, whatever the hell it is. He's got these 6 or 7 gadgets that his caddy has to schlep around the world. But when he gets to the Masters, he's not allowed any of these gadgets. And so, you know, Justin and Jordan kind of tweak him a lot. And so Justin comes up to him and says, Bryson, what are you going to do this week? You don't have your moisture agronomer, whatever the hell it is, for the grass. He goes, no, we know exactly what my caddy weighs. And then the compression mark he makes in the grass, we can measure that. And therefore, Justin's like sprained his eyes, rolling them. But he really did try something that no one had ever tried. This is a guy that had won a bunch of times on tour already, completely changed his body into this Hulk thing, made his swing much uglier. And then it seemed like it was working for a while. Remember, he won that US Open. Where was Wingfoot? Yeah. Just bombing it into the junk and gouging it out and doing something that no one had tried. And so I admire that. And maybe that's a trend going forward. The problem is, what we didn't realize is how much he'd get hurt.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think, you do have to give him credit for there's a lot of innovative stuff that he did. I think for me, some of it comes off as him trying too hard to seem like a genius. But in any event,
that was all great till they all take these bloody checks from the Saudis, a family that beheads protesters, disappears gay people, helped fund 9/11. Well, we're always supposed to remember 9/11, but well, not when it comes to golf. Come on, these guys are great. Let's play golf. No, they're trying to whitewash, sport wash their image, and they're getting away with it. They've won. I mean, they've won. They're here for quite a while until they get bored with it. It's sad, but not for the players. They all get new jets. But as I say, don't get white interiors because those bloody checks are going to stain your seats.
I was going to ask your take on Live Golf, but I think
I hate it.
Summed it up pretty well.
There was some good news last week, though. No journalists were killed, so we're something good's happening.
Fair enough.
I mean, come on.
And yeah, the book came. It's interesting. The book came out, before Live kind of exploded. So I imagine it certainly would have gotten a chapter. It might have been a very different book.
Quick story: the guy that runs Live Golf, one of the Saudi family, royal family, somebody's, comes to this famous country club here in LA. I won't mention it. And he's got 4 security guys in suits, and they're, I'm sure they're armed up. And he needs a caddy, right? So they give him this caddy, and the caddy master, Latino caddy master, and oh, this is your caddy, Adolfo or whatever. And the security guy says, you will call Mr. Whatever sire. You'll call him sire. Yeah. And the caddy master goes, buddy, nobody calling nobody sire out here. okay? And he said, Adolfo, you'll call him Mr. Whatever. And I thought it was great, this little caddy master standing up to the royal.
Hell yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's no sires. Yeah, and caddies and caddy masters in all your work, actually, you know, get a special place. From your book, Who's Your Caddy?
Well, because
caddies, I think your love and respect for
caddies.
You get it.
Because caddies will just completely screw over their tip to get in a shot at you. You know what I mean? Like, I was playing somewhere the other day, and I swung, but I never saw it. And I said, I never saw it. And the caddy goes, it's probably for the best.
Love it. No, they're the great levelers, the equalizer. I mean, I caddy for 12 years, and I never got to the point as an adult caddy, you can really give it out. But, you know, it's in any other circumstance or arrangement in life, on the hierarchy, you know, the doctor's here and the caddy's here. But on the golf course, you know, the caddy has the status, and you got to love that for sure.
I do love it. There's so many good caddy stories in here. Did you know about that caddy, Cal Cad? He had just won, and then he got put in prison for 12 years. And when he got out,
yeah, tell us that one.
Oh, this great caddy that Cal Cad, and he had put all his money, because Cal was winning a lot of checks. So they win the Atlanta Bell South or something like that, but the caddy had put in all his money into a gym. Was going to be a great fitness center in his hometown of Florida, something, and the guy just ran with the money, so he was broke. So this caddy's friend in Michigan said, "Hey man, a lot of guys like coke up here. Send some up." So he FedEx coke up to this guy. The feds find out. He goes to jail for 12 years, and it's a great story in the book. And I can't tell the whole thing here, but the point is, when he walked out, there was Calc waiting for him. I mean, how great is that?
Yeah, right.
And he's
back
right
at
back
it.
Out. And he's got Harris. He had Harris English. He had Michael Kim. He's got, I don't even know who he's got, but he's now caddied in two Ryder Cups. And what's what I mean about family? You know, golf. And when he got back, he had no clothes. And so Bones had all the caddies give him free stuff that they were getting. And they just take care of each other out there. And the caddies are as much part of it than anything.
Great caddy stories throughout the book, and some of the stories though that jump out to me, Rick, are a couple that are very much in my wheelhouse that I said, "Damn, I wish I did that." And that's you going and trying to play the most miniature golf holes in a day, and then assembling this great 18 holes of, you know, your favorite 18 holes of golf, or favorite or wildest, I guess, 18 hole golf course, but. Most unforgettable. Tell us about some of those adventures.
Well, first of all, Tom, I wanted to see if you read the story about the worst book signing in history.
Wait, I don't know if I got to that one. I did move around a little bit. Tell us that, because I've got
people
probably
do with
top
this book
it.
Because they get in the morning to the toilet, and it's perfect enough time to read one of the 82 chapters.
Rick, I wanted to say it's the ultimate back of the toilet book, but I didn't know if you'd take that as a compliment. I think it's a compliment, but it is.
Hey, I wrote this exact length for 23 years at SI. I'm used to it. I just don't want to shake your hand as you come out. You know. Okay, Tom, I got to tell you my worst book signing story, because you've been to a million, right? So I'm in Minneapolis. Share. I'm at the Minneapolis Barnes & Noble. It's snowing. I'm at the Mall of America. This giant, horrible place in Minneapolis where they have a roller coaster inside the mall. So I get there 15 minutes early, like you do, and there's 200 chairs set up. There's two piles, giant mountains of Chips Ahoy cookies. There's two giant coolers of lemonade and water. There's a masking tape line that goes from where I'm going to sign these books all through the store, you know, through children's fiction, history, all the way out the door. And I go up to the lady. I'm like, "Who do you think signing Stephen King? It's just me." She goes, "Oh, we had a lot of interest. I'm like, "I don't know. It's snowing." "Oh, it's Minnesota. It's no problem." So at 7 o'clock, when it was time to go on, there was still just one guy sitting there in shorts and flip-flops and a t-shirt. I'm like, "I don't want to go out there." "Sir, you got to go out there." So I go out there and there's one guy sitting in a 200 chairs. And I go, sir, do you want me to go through the book or tell my spiel, or you want to just help me just sign the book? And he goes, go through your spiel. I go through the goddamn spiel. He's making me do this. I think he's kind of loving it. And so I cut it down to 10 minutes and I'm done. And he raises his hand. Sir, you don't have to raise your hand. You're the only person in the room. Keeps his hand up. Like, yes, what's your question? And the guy goes, can we eat them Chips Ahoy cookies? That's the whole reason he came in. He didn't even buy a book.
Someone's got to eat them. It is such a humbling thing. I remember, doing book signings for, my first book, and I'm hustling and I'm calling bookstores or I'm begging my publicist to get me booked anywhere. And I'm like, I'll go anywhere. And this is when, there were bookstores and malls. Maybe there still are. But they put you out in front of the store and, people would just come by. And I realized the first thing you had to learn at a book signing was where the bathroom was, because that's all anyone was going to ask you. They just come up to the table. Do you know where the bathroom is? It's down there to the right. By the way, would you want, or people come up and, you're behind this huge pile of books and they just be like, yeah, did you write this? And, you're like, no, I'm just the guard. I'm here to protect the books or to show off my Tom Coyne book collection. You get all these crazy, and maybe at one person who'd want the book, but in the meantime, answer all these ridiculous questions. But I had a signing like that in Chicago at the Borders, like their anchor store. I was so excited they booked it.
Yeah.
And I was doing this event. I invited all these people and we come out and there's three people in the front row and they're all my three college roommates and they're just laughing. Oh. Their faces are red, because there's 100 chairs and they're the only three people there. They're loving it.
Books are so abject, humiliating. You're right.
Oh, it's humiliating. And that, but like the back row's full of people because they're just sitting down reading the book that they're there to buy. And then I start talking. So I start talking and they get up and like scatter because they're like, oh shoot, I don't want to be part of this. man. Very, very humbling.
Speaking of books, so I've been going around the country doing country clubs because bookstores are still freaked out about COVID, so they don't do many signings. But country clubs will do it. And so I'll get up in front of, 150 people after, an invitational or book men's day or something. And
I think he saw my cousin at one, a country club.
Yeah, I did.
He was like, hey, Rick Riley was there. And you...
I did. He came up to me.
Pretty cool.
Anyway, so... What I found though afterwards, and again I do Q&A, whatever. But then afterwards, after telling all these stories and saying, the story of overcoming an alcoholic family, you can't believe how many guys come up to me with tears in their eyes. Said I've always wanted to tell people this. For these people, a lot of them were like, my dad would be drunk on the course, and I'd want to walk off. Or I took up golf to get away from my dad because he didn't play it, and a story's worse than mine, guns and knives and stuff, and it's just I always say we're all in this together. We're all kind of going through the same kind of stuff. And the more you can reach out and talk about this stuff and be with each other, and be vulnerable and open. The reason I was so flesh searingly honest in this book was because I always wanted my subjects to be honest with me. And I didn't see how I could go on being a writer if I didn't tell the exact truth of my life. And, in COVID, and now we've given up office buildings, we don't see each other anymore. Golf's one of the few places left where you get to be with someone and you got all that walk between the drive and the next shot. And you can have hilarious talks, but you can also talk real. And to me, that's what I love about golf the most, just the stuff you talk in between the shots and the stories afterwards and laughing your ass off and, a couple beers afterwards and not too many and go home, sober. To my dad's credit, he did sober up at 65, but by then it was kind of too late. I was off having my kids and my own life. But I've had a lot of people, and people come up to me after the club nights and like, I know I'm your dad. I know I need to stop. And so maybe it helps some people. I don't know.
That's amazing, Rick. I do the club circuit as well, and I mean, I haven't had exact. I've had a few of those experiences, but yeah, to be able to your honesty, be able to have that impact on people, man, it really makes it. It really makes it worth it.
And yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your stories in the book. Thanks for sharing them with us today. There's so many more. We could, I mean, I have a long list of so many stories I wanted to touch on, but again, get the book, So Help Me Golf, and check them out for yourself. You're the best, Rick. I've always admired your stuff, and this book is really one to admire. So, and I admire that you support us at the Golfers Journal. Thanks for being a member and a subscriber and for
Yeah,
jumping
I
on.
love
And
it.
thank you.
You
Thanks
guys are
for
doing a great job. Thank you for inventing it.
yeah, it's been a great ride, and it's going, and it's moving on with great momentum into exciting places. So thanks for being a part of it. Thanks everyone for tuning in today. And this will be again, you can probably, well, soon we'll have this up as a podcast for you to listen to again. And Rick, be well. And I hope we get to play some golf when I'm out your way or you're out on the East Coast. Let's do it.
Love to. Thank you.
Be well. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.